Hello there. Today is Wednesday, February 28th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump's son-in-law loses his top security clearance.
When it's denied to you, that's saying a lot about you, your character, your honesty, perhaps your friends, and so on. So, yeah, this is a big deal.
North Korea agrees to talks, but will the U.S. go along with it? Did police responding to a deadly school shooting in Florida do enough? Also ahead, a wood so strong it can be made into a battery. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law and top advisor Jared Kushner has had his security clearance downgraded in a move that will limit his access to the most sensitive information. Kushner was one of several White House aides working with an interim security clearance at the top secret level. According to the publication Politico, they were informed in a memo sent Friday that their clearances would be downgraded to secret level. Kushner, who's married to Trump's eldest daughter Ivanka, will no longer have access to the presidential daily briefing, the most valued U.S. intelligence report. The president has the ability to grant Kushner a permanent clearance, but Trump said Friday he was leaving the decision up to his chief of staff, John Kelly. Joining us now to discuss all of this is Robert Dietz, former special counsel for the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency, and currently a professor at the Schar School of Public Policy at George Mason University. What do you make of all this?
Not gaining a security clearance for cause, it's worse than just not getting a security clearance. It's a comment on your trustworthiness, because that is ultimately what a security clearance is saying. In the end, this person is worthy of receiving the secrets of the nation. And when it's denied to you, it's saying a lot about you, your character, your honesty, perhaps your friends, and so on. So, yeah, this is a big deal.
Do you think this is temporary or permanent, and could the president override this?
Well, the president can always override it, but I think it's my instinct is that I don't think it's going away until Mueller's inquiry is going away.
So you think that the Russia investigation has a lot to do with this?
Yes, certainly, because recall, one of the problems with Mr. Kushner is, as you know, again, I'm getting this all from the press. I know none of this firsthand, but one of the problems has been he keeps adding addenda to the forms he filled out in order to get his security clearance. And as according to the articles, the addenda always have to do with updates on what foreigners he's had contact with. And you know, to the extent these are Russian contacts, and I think that is admitted, of course that's going to have a connection to the Mueller-Russia inquiry.
We're hearing some other things, according to the Washington Post, about Kushner's overseas contacts and concerns as foreign officials were looking to get leverage from him and sort of manipulate him.
Yes.
How do we know this, and what does this mean?
My assumption, and again, this is all taken from the newspaper, my assumption is that that foreign officials were intercepted talking about Mr. Kushner. And so they heard conversations in which the foreign government officials are licking their chops over the potential that Mr. Kushner is manipulable or vulnerable.
The National Security Agency chief, Mike Rogers, told lawmakers that America has the capability to stop the Russian cyber attacks, but he has not been given any orders from President Trump or the White House to do so. What is going on here? This seems worrisome.
Yeah, I think it is worrisome. Bear in mind that as senior as Admiral Rogers is, you know, four-star admiral and all that, as head of National Security Agency and as head of the Cybersecurity Command, as senior as he is, he's still under the Secretary of Defense, and ultimately the President. And certainly he's not going to want to get out front on an issue without getting clear support and instruction from the SecDef and the President. So I think it is worrisome that more isn't being made of this. In terms of the capabilities, the NSA is the finest signals intelligence agency in the world. It has capabilities that no other country has. And if Admiral Rogers says that we have the capability to prevent this, I take that word to the bank.
So we have the capability. We know Russia attacked our country.
Yes.
And they are continuing to do that, and nothing's being done about it.
It is concerning. Bear in mind, as senior as he is, and you know, head of NSA and head of Cyber Command, he's still under the Secretary of Defense, who, of course, is also under the President. And I guess I have a hard time understanding why, you know, Mr. Trump in a cabinet meeting wouldn't say, hey, look, we got to get a handle on this. Do you have any suggestions? And, of course, SecDef inevitably would say, well, I've got this thing called the NSA, and they're pretty good at cyber stuff, so let's get them on it. I do not understand how that kind of a conversation has not been held.
How concerned should we be about the fact that Russia is...
I think we should be very concerned, but it suggests that, you know, certain folks, like the president, aren't that concerned. The foundation stone of any democratic society is elections, free and fair elections. Without those, you don't have a democracy. And so it seems to me that any nation that goes after the free and fair conduct of our elections is an enemy. And I'm not suggesting you, therefore, you know, drop a bomb on them, but that you could take steps, whatever steps are needed, to prevent them from doing that stuff.
That's Robert Dietz, former special counsel of the CIA and NSA, and currently a professor at George Mason University. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. A U.S. task force will target the opioid crisis. The U.S. is cutting aid to Cambodia for its recent democratic setbacks. A California man is arrested for trying to join the Islamic State. And anti-Semitic incidents rose 57% in the U.S. last year. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at VOAnews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Joseph Yoon, the U.S. State Department Special Representative for North Korean Policy, is leaving his post later this week. His retirement comes amid signs that Pyongyang may finally be willing to hold direct talks with Washington. Yoon had strongly advocated direct engagement with the isolated regime and had been holding regular talks with North Korean diplomats assigned to the United Nations. President Trump said Tuesday he hopes for the best, but talks can happen only on condition that North Korea agrees to give up its nuclear program.
So they want to talk. First time. They want to talk. And we'll see what happens. That's my attitude. We'll see what happens. But something has to be done.
State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert issued a statement saying Yoon is retiring Friday for personal reasons and that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has reluctantly accepted the veteran diplomat's decision. She was also asked by reporters about the timing of the departure, given that North Korea had just said it's willing to hold talks.
The State Department has 75,000 people that work for us around the world. To imply that Ambassador Yoon is the only one who's capable of handling North Korea would simply be wrong. We have a deep bench of very experienced people. Our acting assistant secretary, Susan Thornton, who is now a nominee to be the assistant secretary for East Asia Pacific, for EAP, is more than capable of handling that job. She is a fantastic diplomat and well-respected across the Foreign Service and across the world as well.
The 32-year-old State Department veteran Yoon was named Special Representative for North Korea Policy in October 2016 under then-President Barack Obama. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Stephen Norper, Senior Director of the Korea Society, if he was surprised by the announcement of Yoon's departure.
Well, it means that the U.S. is insisting on abandonment of the nuclear front from the onset, meaning denuclearization as a precondition for talks. Ambassador Yoon and others have advocated that that is a good long-term goal. That's the end point, denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. But Ambassador Yoon and at one point Secretary Tillerson suggested that there be no preconditions, that getting to the table was all critical, especially given the high state of tension around the Korean Peninsula.
On Friday, Washington announced its largest package of sanctions yet on North Korea. But in Geneva Tuesday, the North Korean envoy to the UN Conference on Disarmament, Han Tae-song, dismissed sanctions as ineffective, said plans by Seoul and Washington to resume joint military exercises would harm, quote, the current positive process of improved inter-Korean relations.
Right. And so sanctions do seem to be having an initial bite. There are indications that it is having an impact. And South Korean President Moon Jae-in has said that the tougher campaign by the United States, South Korea, Japan, and the international community is what has moved North Korea to the inter-Korean talks. Despite the North Korean envoy's comments, there does seem to be an effectiveness to the process. But the question is really how to ratchet it up, and the fact that there doesn't now, with the absence of Ambassador Yun. In terms of the military exercises, that is an area that we'll have to watch closely because it may be perceived by North Korea as a threat, and North Korea may choose to respond. However, the United States and South Korea has said that those will proceed in April, and that there will be the follow-on full eagle exercises, which is actually joint training that will see the deployment of forces in the latter case. And that will take place in May. So that may be a very tense time for relations around the peninsula.
Were you surprised that Kim Jong-jol, the North Korean general who attended the closing ceremonies of the Olympics twice, suggested the North's willingness to talk to the U.S.?
Well, it's a good signal because he's clearly a hardliner. His arrival in South Korea was not popular among broad swaths of the South Korean public who hold him responsible for the 2010 sinking of the Chonan vessel, the South Korean vessel, where 46 sailors died. But to see the offer of talks from the hardest line element does represent that the North Koreans may be serious, that they may be concerned about this buildup of forces, that they may be concerned about the impact of tensions. And the idea that perhaps they're willing to sit down and talk is something that the U.S. administration, alongside South Korean's administration, should look seriously at, and that is what South Korea is encouraging the United States, its strong ally, to do, to create room and to create space for negotiation.
Well, Stephen, there seems to be a prevailing view that even if the North and the U.S. sit down, the North will not give up its nuclear weapons. Do you think the talks could possibly lead to some preliminary steps along that line?
Certainly preliminary steps in terms of some sort of moratorium on development, on testing, timeout in terms of this, or an off-ramp for the current level of tensions. And that is well necessary because the alternative is a military buildup, and the alternative is mention of military strike or harder realities. And that's what North Korea is seeking to avoid. So it's important at this point in time that the United States and South Korea work in concert, that the United States allow South Korea to have the room to see if this inter-Korean process might just work, or at least work in some degree. And trying to decrease tensions is really key. Otherwise, we're in a conflictual relationship again, and the potential in the late spring for things to become hot and for there to be conflict goes up markedly.
That's Stephen Norper, Senior Director of the Korea Society. Well, a top U.S. general is accusing Russia of sowing the seeds of instability in Syria and across the greater Middle East, part of an ongoing attempt to expand its influence at the expense of the United States and the international community. U.S. Central Command General Joseph Votel told lawmakers Tuesday that Moscow's fueling tensions among all parties in Syria.
Russia's support of the Assad regime has not only propped them up, but has also added complexity to the Defeat ISIS campaign. Diplomatically and militarily, Moscow plays both arsonist and firefighter, fueling tensions among all parties in Syria, the Syrian regime, Iran, Turkey, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the United States, and other coalition partners, then serving as an arbiter to resolve disputes, attempting to undermine and weaken each party's bargaining positions. Despite the key role that our partners on the ground, the Syrian Democratic Forces, and the coalition have played in dealing defeat to ISIS, Russia has placed this progress at risk with their activities, which are not focused on defeating ISIS, but rather on preserving their own influence and control over the outcome of the situation.
Residents said at least six civilians were killed after just a brief pause in fighting when Syrian government warplanes resumed their bombing of the region. David Mack, a former ambassador and a scholar with the Middle East Institute, isn't surprised the ceasefire hasn't held.
I regret that I am not surprised. There are some very bad actors involved on the ground, notably the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad, but also a number of the rebel groups and others who have taken refuge within populated areas like the eastern Ghouta suburbs. And the efforts of Russia to emerge from this problem with some kind of clean bill of health in the international community by showing it is concerned that it shares humanitarian concerns with the rest of the international community and with prominent Sunni Arab governments like that of Saudi Arabia, was almost destined to fail. Of course, it started out, it was going to be a 30-day ceasefire, but with both sides sort of keeping their fingers crossed and saying that didn't mean that they couldn't attack terrorists. And then the Russians thought they would be on safe grounds by setting up these five-hour humanitarian corridors in which relief supplies could get in to the civilian population, innocent civilians, particularly those wounded, elderly children, could leave the area. And basically, what the Russians found is that their Syrian ally was not prepared to play ball and is basically taking advantage of a situation that the Russian government had set up in order to continue their efforts to subdue one of the last remaining strongholds of opposition to the government.
Russian officials blamed the resumption of fighting on rebel groups, but the U.S. State Department says it is clearly Moscow that is causing the issue. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues. As students who survived one of the deadliest high school shootings in U.S. history prepare for what will undoubtedly be an emotional return to school later today, federal and state lawmakers are debating how to prevent young people from losing their lives in what they all agree should be safe confines of the nation's schools. Meanwhile, the Broward County, Florida Sheriff's Deputy Scott Peterson, who was outside the school in Parkland when the shooting occurred, along with others in the Sheriff's Department, continue to be scrutinized about their actions or inaction as the event was unfolding. Joining us now to talk more about it is Ron Hosko, president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund and former assistant director of the Criminal Investigative Division of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So what do you think about concerns regarding the Sheriff's Department?
I think there are legitimate questions being raised about how the sheriff has handled this, the media attention that he's gotten, whether he has been effective in that role. In the meantime, having been in law enforcement for 30 years and now leading a nonprofit that defends or raises funds to defend certain police officers for their actions, you know, I like to be evidence-based. I would like to see the facts. I would like to have more details about what Officer Peterson did, about what others from Broward County did, because I think, you know, first reports are often erroneous. Mm. And I think it is unfair for us to judge them based on information that we don't possess.
Right.
So I'm personally trying to hold off judgment, knowing that active shooter protocols, in a perfect world, it involves multiple law enforcers going toward the sound of gunfire with great immediacy. And here, if in fact the school resource officer Peterson stayed outside knowing full well what was going on inside, that is deeply concerning and I think would be well outside of the expected response for law enforcement.
It sounds like his attorney says that he acted appropriately based on his belief that the gunshots were coming from outside the school. Would an officer in that situation be able to tell whether the shooting was happening inside or outside?
Look, he's been a sheriff's deputy longer than I was an FBI agent, 3 decades. You know the sound of gunfire. You've heard it. You've been on the range next to it. You've probably fired similar weapons. Certainly, the acoustic signature of gunfire is going to be different inside than it is outside. Now, a lot of that depends on how close you are and where you might be standing, what might be deflecting the sound. But I think you could probably assess that pretty darn quickly, whether this is ringing out inside the school or coming from outside the school. And again, you know, it will be, I imagine in this day and age, the school has enough video coverage, perhaps there was video coverage in the neighborhood as well, that will be telling about the timeline of the killer's movements versus Deputy Peterson's movements to see, did he move in any way, shape, or form toward the sound of gunfire? That's the expectation of law enforcement now. It is to go hunt down the threat and mitigate the threat. You know, to use the sheriff's words, go find him and kill him. That is ultimately the goal, is to, for law enforcement to confront the threat as quickly as possible and mitigate it. Very often, probably 40%+ of the time, when confronted by law enforcement or by some other force, these active shooters will take their own life. Whether the press of a law enforcement attack, the law enforcement's arrival, their nervousness, their inability to work their, to function their weapon effectively, very often they turn the weapon on themselves. And even that is a better outcome than more dead kids in the school, more dead innocents in the school. So the timeline, I think, is going to be important. The video and other people's observations are going to be important to kind of peel back the truth here and see if this was truly a failure, if Peterson's attorney's statements are accurate, and help us make judgments.
Well, do you think it's unusual that he resigned so quickly after being told he was being suspended before an investigation even got underway?
I do think that's unusual, and maybe that is a reflection of his consciousness of his own failure, that had he done everything that was expected of him, even if he wasn't in a position to interdict Cruz very, very quickly, as a few minutes passed, I think it's been reported, maybe 4 or 5 minutes, if he was trying to get into a tactical position, wait for a moment for some of the other deputies or police who were arriving, perhaps within seconds, to form up a team, that may take, you know, again, a few moments. If he did nothing, and he knows he did nothing, if he did something tactically, moved in the right direction, directed others to come join him, I would think after this much time in law enforcement, you'd want to stand and defend your reputation and defend your own honor. And this is a very, very quick exit, may telegraph that he knew he did not do enough.
That's Ron Hosko, president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund and former assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigative Division.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published in the journal Science proposes Neanderthals and not modern humans were responsible for creating the world's oldest known cave paintings. The researchers, led by scientists at the University of Southampton and the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology, say that their findings suggest that our closely related prehistoric ancestor may have had an artistic sense like our own. The researchers studied wall paintings found in 3 caves in Spain. Using a state-of-the-art dating technique, the researchers determined that the paintings are more than 64,000 years old. The researchers suggest the cave art, which included pictures of animals and geometric symbols, must have been made by the Neanderthals, since it's thought modern humans did not arrive in Europe until some 20,000 years later. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, a new super material, stronger, lighter, and cheaper than steel, has emerged from scientists' labs. It's not a high-tech nanopolymer or some new alloy. It's wood. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Take regular wood, add solvents, heat, and pressure, and you've got super wood, made 3 times denser and 10 times stronger, says Liangbing Hu at the University of Maryland.
Well, interesting, replacing steel and the carbon fibers by strong wood structures. So you can be, they can be lightweight, strong, and low cost. Think about this kind of test.
Hu is finding new ways to use wood. He and his colleague, Tung Li, have made wood batteries. They made transparent wood.
Wood has been existing on Earth more than 1 million years, and human beings have been using wood for furniture, constructions more than 10,000 years. And then the more we worked on this material, we realized we haven't never fully exhausted the potential of this amazing material.
The key to superwood, Hu says, is partially removing a chemical called lignin.
So the lignin is like a binder to hold all the components together in a natural wood. And in our process, we found out to be able to densify the wood completely, we have to remove some of these binders.
By removing about half the lignin with chemicals and pressing the wood for a day or so, they say it's strong and light enough to build cars, airplanes, wind turbines, and more with it. There's still more work to do, but Li and Hu say someday, lumber mills may take the place of steel mills. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for being with us today, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a beautiful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is increasingly clear that no geographical area is more important to the future of the United States than the Asia-Pacific. It is home to 1/3 of the world's population, produces 1/3 of global GDP, and boasts some of the largest and most dynamic economies in the world, said Acting Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Susan Thornton in recent testimony before the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. But there are very real security and economic challenges in the Asia-Pacific region, including the menacing threat of North Korea, the rise of an authoritarian China, and the spread of terrorism and extremism. The threat from North Korea continues to increase. Tensions and extremism are on the rise, she said. Backsliding on democracy, governance, and corruption and human rights is also undermining prospects for stability and growth in some countries. These problems will not be resolved without strong, determined leadership, and the administration of President Donald Trump is determined and up to the task. In response to Kim Jong-un's attempts to develop North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile capabilities, the United States initiated a maximum pressure campaign of strong diplomatic actions and economic sanctions against North Korea. Many of our allies around the globe have followed suit, restricting or ending North Korean diplomatic activities, severing all trade ties, and imposing or tightening economic sanctions on North Korea. We have also made clear to China our desire for a productive relationship and that we must work to manage and resolve differences. But we will not tolerate any attempts to displace the United States in Asia or to coerce or bully countries in the region. Finally, we continue our work with APEC to promote high standards and fair trade and to support ASEAN-centered regional architecture. The administration under President Trump's leadership is working to expand and deepen partnerships throughout the region via our Indo-Pacific strategy to ensure that countries have support to make their own decisions and don't feel pressured to take on obligations that undermine good governance or long-term growth, said Acting Assistant Secretary Thornton. The United States is a Pacific power and will remain committed to this region's success.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.